From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. This morning, the Labor Department reported that another 709,000 Americans applied for first-time unemployment benefits last week. That's a lower number than many economists had expected, but 8 months into the pandemic, it's still huge. In addition to that, nearly 300,000 people applied last week for Special CARES Act benefits that, for instance, help the self-employed. The jobless numbers come as coronavirus case numbers continue to hit record levels, and as one of President-elect Joe Biden's COVID advisors is floating the idea of a 4 to 6 week shutdown to ultimately help the economy with money to help individuals and government. Let's bring in NPR Chief Economics Correspondent Scott Horsley. Hi, Scott.
Good to be with you, Robin.
And let's listen to a little of Biden COVID advisor Dr. Michael Osterholm, who spoke with Yahoo Finance last night and spoke about this shutdown. Let's listen.
We could pay for a package right now to cover the, all of the wages, lost wages for individual workers, for losses to small companies, to medium-sized companies, for city, states, county governments. We could do all of that. If we did that, then we could lock down for 4 to 6 weeks. And if we did that, we could drive the numbers down.
Scott, does that surprise you to hear that coming from a Biden advisor just a week after the election, which President Trump accused Biden of wanting to shut down the economy?
Well, you know, Biden did say back in August that he would follow the advice of scientific experts if they recommended stricter limits on economic activity. That's in contrast to President Trump, who has often ignored scientific advice in his push to rapidly reopen businesses and schools, an approach that the president has stuck with even after he and his wife and a lot of key White House staffers contracted the virus. But it's not clear that a lot of Biden advisors feel that way. Anthony Fauci was on television this morning saying he's not leaning towards a shutdown. He says there's no appetite for it. He thinks there's more targeted measures that could be taken. Another Biden advisor has said it's like a dimmer switch. It's not an on-off, binary thing. Keep in mind, we've got more than 2 months before President-elect Biden will be in control of this. And in the meantime, we are in a world of hurt when it comes to this spread. I mean, the numbers are really frightening.
Yeah. Well, also, meantime, there's a lot of different definitions of what a shutdown is. In some states, stores, restaurants are ordered closed. In others, people are told, stay at home, only go out if it's essential for you to do that. But even putting that aside, can Biden get this relief that Osterholm was talking about without the Senate?
Hard to do something of that magnitude without Senate help. Now, there is certainly room within the credit markets for the federal government to borrow the kind of money we're talking about. Mitch McConnell has been talking about at least a limited relief package, but certainly the kind of aid that would be associated with that sort of shutdown would require Senate buy-in.
Yeah. Now, we have around 1 million people looking for jobless benefits last week. But also last week, we heard the national unemployment rate dropped last month to 6.9%. Square that for us.
Yeah, it's a little hard to square that. It's encouraging, certainly, that the unemployment rate fell as low as it did in October. And it fell for the right reasons, or it fell even as more people were coming into the job market. Sometimes we see the unemployment rate drop because people are leaving the job market, but that's not what happened last month. So that's certainly encouraging. But we also know that we're only about 54% of the way towards recovering the 22 million jobs that were lost in the springtime. And at the same time, with this new spike in coronavirus infections, we're going to see probably more businesses closing their doors, at least temporarily, more people being laid off. As you mentioned, a million or so people applied for new unemployment benefits just last week. We've got 21 million people receiving some form of unemployment relief as of late October. And importantly, about 13.5 million of those are getting benefits under that CARES Act that are set to expire at the end of December. So at a minimum, Congress is going to have to do something to extend those emergency benefits that were passed back in the springtime, or you're going to have millions of Americans suddenly having their lifeline cut off at the end of the year.
Real briefly, any sense of that idea of some sort of a Peace Corps, let's say for COVID contact tracing, for people who are unemployed would become a reality in the Biden administration?
I'm afraid that with 144,000 new cases in a single day, almost 1,900 deaths in a single day, we're probably past the point where contact tracing is a realistic approach to this pandemic.
NPR's chief economics correspondent, Scott Horsley, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Well, as Democrats look ahead to a Biden administration, there's plenty of blame to go around about why their party failed to live up to the expectations they set for down-ballot races. Elizabeth Spire says the party itself deserves some of that blame for the way it approaches campaigns. She's founder of The Insurrection, a political consulting firm that works with progressive candidates, and she joins me now. Elizabeth, hi.
Hi.
So what do you think went wrong for Democrats in Congress this election, losing seats in the House and underperforming expectations in the Senate?
You know, I think some of it just has to do with not really kind of segmenting the market and understanding that each race is different. I think we have a tendency collectively as Democrats to gravitate toward one size fits all messaging because it's easier to deploy, it's easier to scale. But that might not have worked in this situation. You know, we had a lot of close races where you really needed to customize more based on what the local electorate was really interested in and wanted.
I spoke with Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal yesterday, who echoed other progressive Democrats like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who say that the Democratic ground game is lagging behind, that the Democrats aren't doing a good enough job engaging voters outside the heat of the campaign season. I mean, does that kind of apply to what you're saying there?
Yeah, I agree with that. And, you know, my history is that I've only been working in politics since 2017, and so I have a little bit of a outsider's perspective still. And one of the things that's endemic to particularly electoral politics is that people kind of only think in terms of whatever the current cycle is. So there are a lot of sort of short-term incentives that cut against long-term incentives to really do what I think AOC referred to as deep canvassing, where you're really talking to voters outside of electoral cycles in a way that kind of engages them to an electoral end, but not exclusively that. So the way a typical cycle works, you're talking to voters primarily closest to the election, which is a rational thing to do. But what it means is that you might not be in those communities enough to really understand how the electorate is shifting between cycles. So I agree with them. You know, and I think one of the things that AOC's campaign did well was really being in the community and talking to people and using the tools at her disposal to sort of understand, even on a quantitative basis, what people cared about.
Yeah, and interesting that you point that out. I mean, I've spoken with advocates in Arizona who helped flip the state blue who say they've been doing this for 10 years. They've been in these communities for 10 years, and that's why it happened. But what about digital outreach, social media? Is the Democratic Party missing the boat there?
Well, I think we underinvest. We don't spend as much. We don't spend enough early enough. One of the great things about digital is that it's incredibly cost effective. So in theory, you can start messaging a lot sooner. You don't have to wait until right up against the election because you're not talking about, you know, enormous spends to talk directly to the electorate. I think also we lack a certain kind of digital talent that really understands how voters are consuming media in the current environment. And so there's a tendency to look at baseline political digital as being comparable to what other campaigns are doing and not really thinking about it in a more holistic way, because what you're fighting for in terms of voter attention isn't just the other political messaging that, you know, they're getting on a regular basis. It's the entirety of what they're consuming in media. So what you're competing with isn't necessarily your opponent's campaign. It's everything that's getting put in front of a voter. And I think we just don't have that mentality across the board. The baseline is really what other campaigns are doing and not what the best digital practices are in digital categorically or for messaging categorically.
Do you think the Republicans have you beat in that regard?
I don't know that they have us beat, but they've invested more. And I think they're more likely to think about strategy as, you know, a 10-year proposition and not just in terms of this cycle to next.
They were out there knocking on doors despite the pandemic when Democrats weren't. I mean, I think some people might argue that Republicans, just like you're saying, might have had a bigger picture view of this campaign season.
Yeah, and I think they're less risk averse. You know, one of the things that came out of the Trump campaign in the last cycle And this wasn't strategic on their part, in my opinion, but because they hired Brad Parscale to run digital, and Parscale came out of a commercial environment, and the campaign was just chaos all the time, I think it enabled Parscale to try a lot of things in digital with not necessarily consistent top-down messaging, and they were able to sort of suss out what worked and what didn't. And there's usually not as much tolerance for that kind of experimentation on a typical campaign, but I think it worked to the Trump campaign's advantage. So,
yeah. Elizabeth Spires, founder of The Insurrection. It's a political consulting firm that works with progressive candidates. Thanks for your insight today.
Thank you.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT's System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT's School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a master's in engineering and management. SDM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology. With over 20 years of on-campus, hybrid, and distance education experience, join a virtual info session on Tuesday, November 17th from noon to 1 p.m. sdm.mit.edu.
Polling this election season predicted big wins for Democrats, a wide-open path to the White House for Joe Biden, a Senate controlled by Democrats, and an even bigger House majority. Well, as we know, those forecasts were wrong, again. Joining us now is Michael Schulzen, contributing editor at Undark Magazine. It's a publication that looks at the intersection of science and society. Michael, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
And yeah, sure, the ballots are still being counted in some states across the country, but there is a lot of angst already right now, because yet again, it appears the polls got it wrong. What do you think? Is this a case of deja vu all over again?
I think there are definitely ways where this situation will feel similar to 2016 and ways in which it may turn out to be different. As you said, it's still pretty early. There are still ballots being counted, and there's a lot of data for pollsters and scholars and others to pore over in the coming weeks and months to try to understand where the polls told a story that ended up playing out and where they may have found results that suggested outcomes that did not pan out in the way that was expected.
But we do already have some data. Let's take a look at the national polls in 2020, which were worse than they were in 2016. The polls this year had Biden winning Wisconsin by about 8 points on average. He barely sneaked by. And if the polls were right, then Democrats would have won back Ohio, which of course they didn't do. So what happened? Because after 2016, pollsters made significant changes to their methods. They tried hard to better account for white voters without a college degree, for example. What went wrong this time?
One thing that I'm hearing produce a lot of alarm among pollsters and a lot of curiosity is the sense that not only was there a polling error again, but it seemed to cut in a similar way to in 2016, right? So in 2016, you see a lot of Trump voters coming out who the polls did not seem to account for, that seemed to be concentrated in the upper Midwest. A lot of changes happened since then. There was a big postmortem from the big National Polling Association trying to understand what was going on. Lots of pollsters are going to change their methods. And once again, we're seeing that a lot of Trump voters, for some reason, were being missed in polls, especially in the upper Midwest, and then showed up on Election Day, right?
Right. And let's take a look at the polls from 2018, because actually they looked pretty good that year. And of course, that was a year that President Trump wasn't on the ballot. What about that? I mean, I know people are talking now about whether or not it's just really, really hard to pull a race when Donald Trump is in it.
Yeah, I mean, I talked to a pollster yesterday in Wisconsin who was making this exact point, that it seemed as if the 2018 polls were right on. In the Democratic primary this year, they got very close to calling what was going to happen. And then for some reason, the moment Trump is on the ballot, the situation looks a little bit different. And there's a whole range of speculation about why that may be the case. Is it that there's some subset of Trump voters who are particularly likely to show up for him and for some reason are particularly likely not to trust pollsters or not to answer the phone? Is it that for some reason people are not being entirely forthcoming when they're asked about who they're going to vote for? Is there something about the way that these things were weighted, that these complicated models were trying to account for who's going to vote and who's not going to vote, that for some reason missed the mark?
Yeah. Well, you know, this is just anecdotal, but in some of the reporting that I did over the course of the last couple months leading up to this election, I spoke with Trump voters who were not shy Trump voters. I mean, they were proud Trump voters. And in fact, they told me that they purposefully lied to pollsters because they wanted to throw sand in the gears of something that they saw as sort of the mainstream problem of this country, the media and the polls and all that sort of thing. Now, this is an inflammatory question, I know, but some people are saying that after this election, polls are dead and that we should just stop using them. What do you think? Is that realistic?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been striking that even in the days after hearing those pronouncements, I'm also seeing a lot of reporting and discussion about polls, about, for example, who trusts the outcome of the presidential election and who does not. So there seems to be this way in which at moments of uncertainty, there's this turn toward polls. At the same time, I think that the way in which polls are produced, there's going to need to be real questions. And I think there is going to be a little bit of a reckoning about the way that this data gets used and the way that we perhaps sometimes uncritically put trust in data, which needs to be thought about in a larger context and which needs to be understood for more than as just an absolute number.
Well, and maybe, Michael, the reason that we do that is because we're human beings, and I think we tend to hate uncertainty. We are starving for any data, I'm speaking for myself here and I know for others, that will tell us anything about a race, especially a presidential race. And so, you know, I just wonder how we deal with the fact that we are seeking precise answers to something that is not yet known.
Yeah, I think there's this fascinating question, especially about election forecasts like Nate Silver's 538 and others that have become so popular in the past decade or so, right? About what are they for? What need does it fulfill for us to be looking at these numbers, to, for some people, obsessively checking these numbers ahead? What information does it actually provide that's useful to voters? And people, forecasters and others, will make that pitch and they can make arguments for that. But I do think there are real questions about what it is that we're looking for with this data and whether it actually is providing information to voters that's useful. And again, polls ask a lot of other questions besides who are you going to vote for? And I think a lot of pollsters would say the most useful stuff we're finding is not about how we think people are going to vote. It's about things that are motivating the electorate. It's about concerns that people are bringing in, which may not be so easy to see in other kinds of reporting or in anecdotes, but that are really, really important to some subset of the electorate. These other trends, which are there and which are part of that story, but often are get glossed over from this need to resolve this uncertainty through data.
Michael Schulzen, contributing editor at Undark Magazine, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Well, as we mentioned at the top of the hour, the number of Americans seeking unemployment benefits fell last week to 709,000. That's a sign that job losses may be slowing, but still running at very high levels. In short, a lot of people looking for jobs. And in the gig economy, the competition for them is getting fierce. Thousands of people have entered the gig workforce for the first time, and that has some established gig workers finding it harder to make a living. Joshua McNichols from member station KUOW has the story from Seattle.
Orlando Santana is a graphic designer and a photographer. He first tried gig work in Seattle after getting laid off from a newspaper 3 years ago, and he found he loved it.
During that time, the pay was better than what I was making as a graphic designer. So I stuck with it, and then being able to flexibility semi-annual schedule, like, it was great.
Before the pandemic, Santana would juggle work on 7 different gig apps, doing everything from shopping for groceries to walking dogs. But then the pandemic hit and temporarily wiped out work on more than half of the gig platforms he worked for. He and many other gig workers swarmed the platforms that still had work, like Shipt and DoorDash and Amazon Flex. Instacart alone has signed up 300,000 new workers since the pandemic began. Santana says all those new people flowing into the gig workforce made it harder for him to earn a living doing things he used to do, like shopping for groceries and delivering them for Instacart.
It's almost impossible to, like, open it up, see, like, where the store is, where the delivery address is, kind of figure out, like, was the pay worth it for the amount of time I'm going to spend.
Before the pandemic, he could take the time to figure out which jobs would pay well. But now he has to snap them up without thinking, because otherwise they disappear.
It'll be gone so fast. It's almost like a frenzy.
Santana says he ends up taking jobs he should be turning down because they make him less than minimum wage.
You're stuck with, you know, accepting $7, $8 to go do, you know, 45 minutes, an hour's worth of work.
Instacart's statistics show that overall, pay has increased for its gig workers during the pandemic. But that's not true for all gig workers. Santana's income has dropped by half. He says Amazon's grocery delivery jobs pay a little better, but competition for them is fierce. Aviana Brown faced a similar problem. Before the pandemic, gig work supported her career as an artist.
I worked really hard to save money, and while paying off things, while taking care of medical bills, while gig working, while working 18 to 20 hour days.
She managed to climb out of debt and build up a nest egg. Then the pandemic reduced her gig work so she couldn't keep up with her bills.
It was just really disheartening to not have any income and to just see all this money wash away as if it had never existed.
Eventually, she moved in with her parents on the Yakima Indian Reservation in eastern Washington. These two gig workers, Santana and Brown, are examples of a larger trend. Many gig workers are hurting, even as we hear stories about gig work booming. Becky House works for a nonprofit credit counseling service called American Financial Solutions. The organization used to see a lot of people who relied on income from gig jobs to pay down their debts. But those people aren't showing up for counseling anymore.
The difference now is that people don't have the income to really work on trying to pay down their debts. So they're really, really struggling.
That doesn't surprise Sage Wilson of Working Washington. That's an organization that promotes better pay and benefits for workers. He says many gig apps drive pay down.
It's built into the design of some of the platform's pay models to silently lower the pay rates when there's more competition among workers for the jobs.
Still, Wilson says gig apps aren't necessarily bad. They give workers flexibility. But he says when there's no official minimum wage for gig workers, there's nothing to stop those wages from dropping through the floor. And he says the legacy of those lower wages could hurt people long after the economy recovers. He's asking gig companies to meet a higher minimum pay standard, one that accounts for expenses like mileage, gas, and the time workers spend trying to win gigs each morning. For Here and Now, I'm Joshua McNichols in Seattle.
Murder hornets are here and multiplying. Scientists in Washington State found and destroyed the first known nest of the invasive Asian giant hornets in the U.S., and they discovered about 200 queens inside. Those queens could have left the nest to start their own colonies, but they were stopped, as one scientist put it, in the nick of time. Chris Looney is an entomologist at the Washington State Department of Agriculture, and he was there to help destroy the nest. Chris, welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
Sure, and take me to the scene of this tree that you found these hornets in. What did you find inside?
Well, I mean, we found a well-developed nest of Vespa mandarinia that seemed to be doing just fine and was ready to kick out the next generation of queens.
Okay, well, a lot of people who don't know much about hornets, which I guess is most of us, you know, can't even picture what that nest would look like. You know, when you got up close, what did you see?
Most of us have probably seen a paper wasp nest, you know, like an exposed comb with all the little larvae stuck up inside. So I imagine several of those stacked on top of one another, safely ensconced in a tree with only one little opening to go in. And then, you know, those were crawling with a bunch of already emerged virgin queens, a few workers, and then there were another 100 or so pupae waiting to emerge, some of them chewing their way out as we worked.
Oof, how did you find it? How did you get close enough to handle it safely?
So we found the nest by capturing a live wasp, putting a radio transmitter on it, and then simply following it through the woods. Then we realized it was up in a tree, and we had to revise our plan. We'd been basing it on finding them in the ground, which is where they most commonly nest. We came back early in the morning a few days later, and we sort of blocked off all the places the wasp could possibly get out except for one small hole, and then we harassed the nest by banging on it and vacuuming out the workers as they emerged to defend themselves. Once that happened, we were able to seal the nest back up with spray foam, cut the tree down, and then take it to a quarantine facility where we opened it in a cold room.
Whoa. As I said, one of your colleagues said you got there just in the nick of time, but What are the chances? You don't know. What are the chances that some of these hornets got out, started their own nests in other places?
A few might have escaped. I'm actually still measuring the cells to see if we can really come up with an educated prediction of how many might have already left. But it wouldn't have been very many, and that's normal. This insect, at about this time of year, the next generation of queens emerge. They have to mate successfully, which mating is relatively low in this species. Then they have to fly off and successfully hibernate. They have to wake up in the spring, get enough food, start a nest. So even if, say, a handful of queens emerged, the chances of any one of them being able to start a nest are very, very low. Now, that likelihood goes up, of course, if we had not found the nest and all of those potential queens had been able to fly away.
Yeah, I know you are a scientist, so you probably hate the name murder hornets. I'm just presuming here. It sounds very scary, sure, but you know, how concerned should we really be about this invasive species in America?
We should be concerned about it, but primarily because we're worried about its impact on cultivated honeybees. While it is dangerous to humans and certainly can cause deaths, it doesn't seem to do that at a rate that's any greater than our native species. So aside from the incredibly painful sting, people should be worried about their own health and safety.
So the murder is referring to the murder it does to the honeybees?
No, I think actually the murder is referring to its impacts on people, but it was sort of a tongue-in-cheek nickname, as far as I could tell, based on the conversation that Mike Baker had with a Japanese scientist. So I think the name's kind of funny myself because it's ridiculous.
It is. It's catchy. I mean, it's going to get a headline, that's for sure. Dr. Chris Looney, an entomologist with the Washington State Department of Agriculture, on the scene of the first murder hornet nest found in North America. Thanks so much for your time.
Hey, you bet. Take care.
It's a snapshot no one wanted to see, but many expected. Hospitals in Mississippi, Oklahoma, and Tennessee now nearing capacity. In El Paso, Texas, mobile morgues are being set up outside treatment centers. 154 bodies were being held there as of Tuesday. A stay-at-home order there has been extended until next month. As COVID-19 cases soar, epidemiologist Michael Osterholm, a new Biden COVID advisor, is calling this time COVID hell. We haven't heard a word from sitting President Donald Trump, and the head of the coronavirus task force, Mike Pence, is reportedly focused on helping the president contest last week's election. But Lori Garrett has been sounding the alarm since the first days of the pandemic. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning science author and authority on global health and pandemics. And Lori, I welcome you back with caution because when we first spoke months ago, your hair was on fire. I can't imagine how you feel now. How would you characterize where we are now?
Robin, we're in exponential growth. We are in a situation unlike anything we have faced in this epidemic to date, and frankly, unlike anything we've faced in many, many, many years. The closest would be where we were with the H1N1 swine flu in 2009, which was fortunately a rather benign microorganism. Where we are now is that we are in an all 50 states at once epidemic. Every state is showing increases. In at least 43 states, the increases are at or approaching exceeding their immediate hospitalization capacities. I'm talking to you from New York, where we had a terrible, terrible spring, as everybody knows. We got through it in large part because it was possible to recruit healthcare workers from neighboring states. But now every state needs additional healthcare workers. Every state needs more morgue capacity, more funeral parlor operators, more coroners. The list goes on and on and on. And so in many ways, the scenario that President Trump imposed on the nation is now playing out. States' rights. Well, now we have states' rights, as in you have a right to run your own epidemic any way you choose. Don't expect leadership from us. You're on your own. Well, now they really are. Now the sort of cooperative mechanisms that many governors set up that helped them get through the last two surges won't make any difference because nobody can share. Nobody has extra masks, extra ventilators, extra supplies of essential drugs, extra nurses, extra doctors. So we are heading into a winter of true hell. I mean, the gates of Hades have opened.
But Lori, I hear you. But put aside the lack of leadership, the politicizing of masks. Why has this happened? I've been hung up on, and maybe I'm wrong, the fact that because this is so contagious, we're not seeing it as much. We're not seeing people not able to breathe. People can't go into hospitals and do the reporting that they'd like to do. Why, in your mind, are we here?
I think there's two things. As you pointed out, the majority of people who are infected have no outward symptoms. In fact, even people who are quite severely ill, you know, may actually be able to sit in on a Zoom call. And you look at them on that Zoom call and you say, yeah, they're still working. But they're very, very sick. And we now know they're sick in ways that are going to have, for many of them, lasting impact, possibly permanent impact. So we are seeing a strange situation where up to 60% of all transmission of this virus is coming from people with no outward symptoms of any kind. And that means that it's easy to minimize it and say, I don't see people dropping dead in front of a bus. This isn't so bad. It is very invisible. The second part of that is that the only countries that have done well in fighting off COVID are countries that have had national policies that were decided at the top and were uniformly executed across the entire nation.
You've been tweeting and writing about the really clear difference between Canada and the U.S. There's a huge amount of disease on one line, you know, across the border into the U.S. You go just a few miles and it's completely different.
That was the case. Now, unfortunately, all of North America is getting spillover from us. We now are in an all of North America disaster that won't come down until we control ours. If you look at countries that have done extremely well, take Japan, for example, or Iceland, South Korea, these are all places where public health systems have executed policies the same from one village to the next. They knew that whatever pain they were going through, the guy down at the next county was going through the same pain. We don't have that. We have a situation where Sturgis could say, sure, bring 450,000 maskless motorcycle riders and have them all crowd into a town that normally only has a couple of thousand people in it and let them party for a week with heavy amounts of alcohol. And oh, right, not a single one is going to wear a mask. And that's okay, says the Dakotas. Well, now, where do we see the highest per capita rates of this soaring epidemic and deaths? It's the Dakotas.
And the Sturgis bike rally was in South Dakota, and people died after that from COVID.
And cases went to neighboring states as the bikers returned home, so that Minnesota and Indiana and Wisconsin and Michigan, all these states from which people biked to South Dakota, suffered. Where we are now, and my great fear for immediate short-term forecasting is this. It is not a government that has much attention placed to the COVID crisis. This epidemic is soaring at such a pace that by Christmas, we could well have 400,000 cumulatively dead Americans, be seeing death rates at about 2,000 or more daily, and have such an out-of-control situation that when Joe Biden steps in, he'll inherit the sort of disease equivalent of what Barack Obama inherited from George Bush in the financial sector.
Okay, real quick, we'll link people to your writing. You're one of many saying the news about a vaccine is great news. However, with many caveats, including we don't yet know how to refrigerate it. You know, we don't know how to distribute it. And even if the vaccine is fully rolled out, we'll still have to wear masks, which, by the way, there's new reporting that the masks are to protect the wearer as much as protecting the people around the wearer. But what else, given that there's however many days till January, what else can people do right now?
Absolutely everybody has to revisit their plans for Thanksgiving and Christmas and whatever other holidays they're celebrating and say, nope, we're not going to travel. We're going to have to figure out another way to share these sacred holidays with our loved ones, because I otherwise think that we're going to look at Thanksgiving and say, this is the moment when we took a super spreader and made it an international super spreading event. And there are a lot of creative ways to think about how to have family, warmth, love, sharing, and feasting without actually putting your five-year-old and your grandmother in the same room together. The second thing is everybody is going to have to take a deep breath and think carefully about what this outdoor eating and restaurants is, what this outdoor entertainment is, and recognize that it's all going to be pretty tough to adhere to as temperatures drop below freezing. And what can you do as an alternative with friends that gives you a sense of community and helps you to get through this very, very tough winter?
New reporting shows that restaurants are the main spreader of the coronavirus, four times more than, you know, for instance, other places people might go, like salons.
Also, private parties. You think you know all your friends, you think you know all your family, and you think that, you know, well, they're all safe and cool. No, if you haven't been together for weeks on end, somebody in that group is likely to be carrying virus. The moment you start hugging someone you haven't seen for weeks, yes, it's good for your soul and for your heart, and we all long for it. But that is the moment when you are sharing a risk and a threat that wasn't there before you had that hug.
And we want the hug so bad, but Lori Garrett, we hear you. Just for a while longer, let's get through this. Lori Garrett, Pulitzer Prize winning author of The Coming Plague. Lori, always great to have you on A Reality Check. Thank you.
Thank you.
Here's a statistic that sports fans are paying close attention to right now. The number of college football games postponed because of coronavirus. The Southeastern Conference, filled with colleges where football is just about on par with religion, has postponed at least four games this weekend because of COVID-19 cases on the teams. That includes the Alabama-Louisiana State game, which is usually one of the biggest events of the season. Tomorrow's Ohio State-Maryland game has also been canceled because eight Maryland players have tested positive. Mike Pesca is here and now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. And you know, Mike, I don't know. I feel like a broken record every time we talk because these college football programs just keep getting hit by COVID. Do you think at this point the season has reached a crisis point?
You know, I would think, rationally speaking, that should be the case. But there are a couple instances or a couple of reasons why you could argue that maybe the powers that be in college football don't think it's the case. And it's namely that they haven't announced contingency plans for expanded playoffs or different scheduling for the postseason. And different conferences have different postseason dates. But, you know, at this point, Wisconsin has missed a couple games. LSU will have missed a couple games. You're talking about huge teams that are missing games. Also, big players like Trevor Lawrence, the Heisman favorite, until he had a positive test, or at least was contact traced and not allowed to play in that big game where the Clemson Tigers lost to Notre Dame. So it really is getting to the point where you have to say, when is someone going to make a decision about going forward with a college football schedule that doesn't look like the college football postseason schedule now? It hasn't happened yet. Don't know how much more information they need until they get that meeting and those plans in place.
You've got to wonder if something might change. I mean, maybe they won't call off the season, but, you know, for example, there are fans that are allowed at some of the college football games being played around the country. I mean, you know, maybe does that stop?
Yeah. So these college football stadiums in some states are saying, you know, a quarter of the stadium can be filled, which sounds pretty small. But then when you're talking about college football and 110,000
people
seat stadium, yeah, 25,000 people show up at a Texas A&M game and they tell them, OK, you all have to wear masks, and some don't comply and they kick a few dozen out. I referenced Notre Dame. They beat Clemson. The fans stormed the field. If you look at the tape, a lot of them wore masks, but there was no social distancing. President of Notre Dame admonished the students for being selfish. Of course, as you remember, this is the same president, Father Jenkins, who went to that ceremony in the White House when Amy Coney Barrett was nominated.
Right.
So there was a contretemps about that. you're absolutely right. So many people are acting as if there isn't a spike and isn't a pandemic, and we're seeing the results of that.
What about the NFL? What's the conversation happening in pro football about how their season is going with COVID?
Now, one of the reasons I was, if you could tell, mildly critical of college football is that pro football has been on top of it. And they are issuing contingency plans. And they have a plan to possibly expand not only the regular season to an 18th week to get all the games in, but if that can't happen, to expand the playoffs, to allow some more teams in. And they've also, I do have to say, they have also, I think, been very honest and rigorous about their testing, because they have made players miss games who aren't actually positive, but who have had one positive test or who have contact traced themselves out of a game or out of practice. It has affected games. You know, Ben Roethlisberger can't practice with the Steelers this week because he was close to Vance McDonald, his tight end, who was positive, but they hope to have Roethlisberger back by Sunday. I would have to assess that the NFL is doing as good a job as you can do if what you're trying to do is get, you know, 100 people roster and organizations to travel around the country to play a game.
Well, and just briefly, Mike, because I want to talk about something non-COVID related. Why do you think that is? Why is the NFL better? You know, I don't know if better is the right word, but why are they more on top of this than the NCAA, for instance?
Well, I would have to say that the fact that their employees are employees with rights that can bargain plays a huge part of it.
Yeah. All right. Well, can we please talk about something other than COVID that's sports related? Do you mind?
You want to talk Cy Youngs?
Could we? Yeah, baseball announced the Cy Young Awards. The best pitchers in the league yesterday, Trevor Bauer, Cincinnati Reds won in the National League, and Cleveland's Shane Bieber in the American. Let's just talk about something blessedly sports related.
Sure.
First, yeah.
These guys were teammates on the Cleveland Indians a year and earlier, and from what I heard, Bauer saw that they were both favorites or near favorites to win the Cy Young before the season, and texted Bieber and said, "Let's go 2 for 2," and it happened. It happened. Bieber's a flamethrower. He had 77 innings pitched and 122 strikeouts, so most of his outs were on strikeouts. Bauer is this interesting guy who sometimes chafes because he thinks he's smarter than everyone, but he might be. And he just uses these advanced statistics to aid him in all sorts of things like delivery and release point. And he resurrected his career a couple of years ago, and now he is or was named the best pitcher in the National League. This is the first time a Cincinnati Red has won that award. This is a 100-plus-year-old franchise.
Well, it's good news for the state of Ohio, isn't it? You got the Cincinnati and Cleveland both covered. Mike Pesca, here at Now Sports Analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, always a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.
When Joe Biden promised to extend protections for DACA recipients on his first day in the White House, young immigrants rejoiced. DACA and the Biden administration next time on Here and Now.